You're listening to the Addicted to Fitness podcast, brought to you by Elemental Training Tampa. Now, here's your hosts, Nick and Shannon Birch.
Thank you for stopping by and checking out this week's edition of the Addicted to Fitness podcast. We really appreciate you guys checking us out, and we'd really, really appreciate it if you take time out of your busy day, just a few minutes, and go give us a rating or review on iTunes. You may not know, but it really does help us kind of reach a broader audience. The ratings make us easier found when people search for like fitness podcasts. Also, another way, a surefire way to help spread the podcast is to share it with a friend or friend. Share it with a friend or friend, friend or family, or anybody you think might enjoy the information we dole out on a week-to-week basis. You can share it by the podcast app, or just give us a share on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. You know, give us a retweet or something like that. With all that podcast business taken care of, now we're going to dive into our health topics we're going to talk about today. And to let you know what those are, I'm going to throw it over to my co-host.
Well, thank you very much. So today we're going to be diving into, I feel like this is a near and dear topic because it took me a long time to really become one of these people, which is a label reader. So we're going to talk about nutrition labels, what to kind of keep a lookout for, and also knowing that not everything on your label is exactly what it seems. So we're gonna kind of dive into a little bit on one specific label type, which is grass-fed. You see it on a lot of products. We're gonna talk about what its shortcomings are and kind of what to look for in the stores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, reading food labels, we've already mentioned it in previous podcasts, is important to help, you know, leading, you know, eating cleaner, eating healthier. So, but there's different kind of ways they're interpreted, or the words they use on the label are interpreted. So we're going to get into that. But before we do, we're going to talk about our ETT training for the week. A little bit of a lighter week. We had some clients either out of town, and I have one client in particularly who I believe, I haven't heard from him this week, but was expecting his baby. Him and his wife were expecting their second child, so I didn't hear from him this week. We saw him at the group workout last week, so hopefully, I'm assuming everything went well. So I've seen him on Facebook. He's still posting on there, so I'm assuming everything's good to go. I had my buddy Tyler, who used to, you guys will hear every once in a while when we do a throwback podcast. He did a little striking training this week, which is a little departure for him because he's been doing more kind of HIIT stuff. He's incorporated more of that. Mm-hmm. He wanted to get away from the striking every session. So every once in a while now, we'll throw it in there, and he got to do it this past week. So
switching things up.
Yeah, you can see his striking video on our Instagram feed, ET Tampa. He's got good technique. So when he told me he was kind of getting a little tired of striking, I was disappointed because I thought he was really good at it. But, you know, we get to throw it in every once in a while. Now it's a treat. For myself, actually recently, I was able to get on the Peloton cycle. And while I was on there, I had an idea for a little bit of an experiment. I'm going to try to see what may be the best exercises calorie-wise. 10-minute exercise, bike, Peloton cycle or stationary bike, jump rope or shadow boxing. So we got the little calorie counter, the little heart rate monitor, and I can see how many calories I burn in those 10 minutes of all three exercises. So maybe do that for an experiment. I don't know about podcasts, that'd be tough, but maybe just do it, you know, as a blog post and post my results on there.
Well, based on a previous podcast, which you might want to link to, we actually talked about what various exercises do within, I think it was like a 20-minute period.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And spinning was right up there.
Yeah.
So I think like swimming might have been more of a calorie burner. I'm not right. Sure, but it was way up there. Yeah. So I would be very interested to find out from the heart monitor.
Yeah, heart rate monitor. Yeah.
Side how it goes.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
I don't know. I just had an idea when I was doing my spinning, my Peloton session this morning. I was like, oh, let me try that.
What instructor did you choose this morning?
I think one of your favorites. The
guy, girl?
Woman, yes.
Hannah?
Maybe. I don't remember.
She cute? Brunette?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're all cute, right? I mean, even the guys are cute.
Wait, mm-hmm. What? Pretty much.
That was my training for the week. What about you? What kind of training you? You said you were bragging about how good your training was this week.
Well, I'm not saying it's good. I'm just saying it was like, for me, it was a really satisfying week. I know we talked about last week, I just kind of been getting back into some routines after kind of like just some health issues and down weeks. And I actually tracked like my month of September, which now we are officially in October. Mm-hmm. So my month actually didn't look that bad. The last 2 weeks, both weeks, I have worked out 5 days in the week. And this past week, I did a great variety. So I did, I think it was like 3 days of, 2 or 3 days of spinning, 1 or 2 days of HIIT workouts. And then I went for a run this morning. My first, like, just solo run in probably 3 months, which felt oh so good, especially since it was lovely outside.
Yeah, first day of October, apparently the, at least for now, the humidity was gone.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I think we're in a cool front right now, yeah. So enjoy it while you can. Yeah,
right. Where'd you go for your run?
The Riverwalk.
Oh, of course, the Riverwalk.
It is my favorite, and it's also, I feel like it's the safest.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's probably going to be our official spot for the, you know, our free monthly group workouts. The feedback we got from, you know, participants last week, they really enjoyed it. So, and it's such a good location, and
yeah,
we got to take advantage of it. So, you know, we're going to be planning the October edition coming up soon. So you guys pay attention to that. We'll let you know when that's going to be. Hopefully if you're in the Tampa Bay area, you can join us.
I think I know when it's going to be.
Don't tease it yet. All right, so let's get into some of the health topics Shannon introduced in the beginning of the podcast. The first one we're going to go into is a food label breakdown. What we mean by food labeled, we're not talking about maybe the nutrition facts on the side. I think that we'll probably go over that in another podcast. We're talking about mainly words that they use on labels that can kind of be sometimes misleading or misinterpreted, mm-hmm. for sure. The words that we're looking at today that are on labels a lot are natural, non-GMO, GMO, gluten-free, and organic.
And so, then grass-fed.
Yes, the grass-fed, that one's kind of, we're going to get a little bit more in detail about this than grass-fed because apparently it's become even more of a complicated term nowadays. So we are looking at the Healthy Living Made Simple website. This is a magazine also, and the great Mario Lopez is on the May-June 2016 the cover. So I know it's good now. So, like I said, they talk about natural. The term natural, you see it on a lot of labels. And it, one thing they were saying is that when they see that word or when people or consumers see that word, they're more apt to buy that product.
Yeah, and I would say like a lot of these terms really have become marketing terms. And I'm going to put a disclaimer down right now. And this is based off of my learnings over my life so far.
Mm-hmm.
Labels, unless they have a organization to back them up, meaning that there is a group, preferably a privatized group that is not influenced by the government, you really don't know what that definition, the word doesn't have a specific definition. And marketers, of which I am one, we'll use those words and abuse those words, to be honest. I mean, you use it to sell products. And I think everybody sees a lot of these terms and they automatically just say, oh, that sounds good, I should get that. Because, I mean, all natural, that's a really good example.
Right.
It just sounds like something you should get. But it kind of, I mean, like all of them, you have to kind of get to the basis of it.
So this, the FDA considers all natural products are, it means that nothing artificial or synthetic has been added. The policy does not include pesticides, artificial growth hormones, or GMO products.
Which is basically all the things I would personally term as unnatural.
Wow.
Well, I mean, it also, this says that there currently is no legal definition for all natural.
Yeah, so like you kind of mentioned, producers can just slap it on there without on. Really, there's no really requirement. They can put it on there and, I mean, there's pesticides. I don't know how natural pesticides, I mean, there are natural pesticides.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
But chances artificial are they're chemical.
Artificial growth hormones. Artificial, I mean, that tells you that they're not natural. So yeah. It's such a broad word, and mainly, like you said, it's just a kind of
a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
I hate to say it. It's totally true.
All right. The next term we're going to go into is non-GMO. GMO, for anybody who doesn't know, is genetically modified organism.
Please don't go on your Monsanto rant in the comments. No, not you. I mean, whoever's listening to this, because I know there's some very strong feelings, and they've been in the headlines a lot lately.
Well, it's funny, because Monsanto, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I will for a second.
But
Monsanto really got kind of bastardized by documentaries like Food Inc. being one of the main ones. Monsanto is one of, I think, the last time I looked, because my other job, I do work with chemicals, so we see a lot of, you know, facts and figure about chemical producers.
Yeah.
Monsanto was in the teens of the top chemical producers.
Yeah.
They were, I believe, 14th. So there was 13 bigger chemical producers in the United States.
Oh, and...
And Monsanto just got bought.
Is being acquired.
By Dow.
Yep.
Bayer? Dow.
Bayer.
Yeah, so the guys who make your aspirin.
Company. Yeah.
They also make chemicals, obviously, to pesticides and herbicides.
Yes.
So I think it's funny that people jumped on Monsanto, even though they're not even the biggest issue.
Yeah.
You know? So I've always thought that was kind of, I mean, it's not comical, but, it's
just one of these sad stories where, like, people's eyes were open to something this company does.
Yeah.
And, like, they just grabbed on and rode that sucker into the ground. So I can only imagine where that's going. But that's kind of, I feel like one of the buzzwords around GMO, non-GMO. There's like this whole movement now. So what exactly are we talking about when we talk about non-GMO?
So non-GMO, the FDA states that food manufacturers may voluntarily label their foods with information about whether the foods were produced without using bioengineering, as long as such information is truthful and not misleading. The non-GMO project is the leading private certification group in the United States. Products they verify as non-GMO display their logo. So that was kind of talking about what you were just alluding to before about a private company.
They are usually better.
I've seen some of our vegetable products we buy that have the non-GMO product, and I think that's becoming a popular label.
Yes.
So it seems like if you see that, the non-GMO project label on a package, you can trust them if you are looking for non-GMO products.
Now, yeah, specifically the non-GMO project, though,
yes.
Not just... non-GMO, because again, that's a term people can just put on something. But again, those private organizations, those are the ones, their labels specifically are the ones you want to look for.
Right. And we're not going to touch the GMO topic right now.
No, that's a separate podcast and probably a couple rants.
Yeah, do your own kind of investigation into GMOs, if they're good or bad. I mean, there's some evidence for both sides. And I'm kind of torn because...
Well, you come from the farming background,
right,
too.
Exactly. And GMO is, you know, trying to produce the best product out in the field is done, too. But
we're not going to go there.
All right. So the next one was GMO. And obviously, we kind of just touched on that. GMO is genetically modified organism. Let's just see what they wrote about. Evidence on the safety of GMO food is extensive. The World Health Organization stated GMOs food currently available on the international market have passed safety assessments and are not likely to present. That's important.
very important.
And are not likely to present risk for human health. That being said, there are still many people who choose to avoid GMO food. processed products that contained at least 70% organic ingredients can use the phrase made with, I don't know why they just put that in there. That was weird. Like I said, I don't want to get too far onto this topic, but GMOs, kind of make your own decision. Do the research. I'm sure we'll talk about that eventually on a podcast because it's important to me.
And something I think that I personally am a little curious about is genetically modified means that they're basically utilizing science to force a mutation in a particular organism.
Well, it's a broad definition. Like, there's people who will tell you there's different definitions. Like, yeah. When I think genetically modified, I think about taking a tomato plant that is, you know, one tomato variety. Plant that has a good, a redeeming quality that I want to have, and then another one, and trying to hybridize them to make a better product.
Right.
But there's also the GMO that they...
happens in a lab.
They make corn, or they make soybeans, or wheat... that is resistance that are, you know, they are resistance to
drought or fungus or pesticides. Whatever. Yeah.
Like the Roundup Ready corn or soybeans.
Yep.
You can spray Roundup, which is a herbicide, on them, and it won't affect them. You know?
Okay.
They can withstand, even though it's an herbicide, it's meant to kill weeds. They can withstand it once you spray it on.
It really does cover a pretty extensive gamut of ways that something could be altered.
Yeah.
Some more traditional and probably long-standing. Some a lot more scientific and in a lab. And
right, yes.
Getting to the molecular level.
Yeah, like you mentioned, farmers have been doing GMO essentially engineering, but and not in the...
That's how you come up with different cultivars of a plant.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, that's why there's so many varieties of tomatoes there are nowadays.
I love tomatoes.
Exactly, because people...
They want
certain redeeming qualities in the plant, so they made it with another one to try to produce that preferred product. So
definitely
GMO,
a big topic.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Holy cow.
And yeah. Okay. Sorry. I was going to go on to let's keep going.
If anybody's interested in revisiting, having us dive a little bit deeper into the whole GMO conversation, maybe we can even find an expert, whether it's a farmer or someone to talk to. I think it's a really hot topic. We could probably go on for hours, but let us know if it's something that you're interested in hearing about.
All right, so the next one is gluten-free.
Oh, jeez.
We've talked about gluten. You know, people have been avoiding gluten for a variety of reasons. People say gluten causes inflammation. And of course, there's people that already have autoimmune syndromes like celiac disease.
My cousin has that. It's awful.
I can imagine. I'm kind of on the bandwagon for kind of the effects of gluten. I think especially processed food, refined gluten products that have gluten, I think they can really cause a lot of inflammation, a lot of health issues. But let's talk about what the definition of gluten-free is.
I think this is probably one of the most abused terms from a marketing standpoint in the last 4 years. I think that it's been slapped on freaking everything.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
That and vegan. Because I'll see vegan on products that you're like, yeah, no S, it's vegan. it's like coconut oil, you know, and coconut oil is gluten-free vegan. And I'm like...
And you're like, why do you need to see that?
Yeah. Duh.
Look at lettuce.
Yeah.
It's vegan.
Yeah, exactly. 2013 FDA guidelines state that a food may call itself gluten-free if it contains less than 20 parts per million of gluten. All right, so gluten-free has a small amount of gluten, but apparently there's, I don't know, depending on how bad your celiac disease is.
Yeah, I think this is one of those where you kind of have to tread carefully, because from a gluten-free standpoint, probably most gluten-free labels that follow the FDA guidelines, again, it's just a FDA guideline here, folks. This is not a private organization stamping this with gluten-free. I think that for most people, it's going to fit with their gluten-free lifestyle if that's something they're avoiding. But if you do have like a disease like celiac or something like that, I mean, my poor cousin has told me horror stories where, like, even the if it's something is made in the same kitchen as, like, gluten products, she gets violently ill. I mean, my heart goes out to her because I had lactose intolerance at one point in my life and I thought that was bad, but it's nothing compared to someone with really sensitive celiac disease.
I mean, it sounds like a severe allergy. Almost.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that she can really rely on the labels for gluten-free, because not only do the labels kind of sort of mislead, but it's shocking the number of things people don't know that gluten's in.
Right.
So
that's another thing too.
This is definitely, I think, a label that's abused, and it's going to be misleading if you have a serious health condition. Probably not something you should follow, but most people are probably safe. You know, right. It's probably not that bad.
I think they're jumping on the bandwagon that people see that try to go gluten-free, even if they don't have, you know, celiac disease, that they tend to be, you know, they lose weight, they feel better, things like that. So producers
see that.
We eat a lot
of gluten-free.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, we don't necessarily get like gluten-free bread or anything.
No,
we
make all of our gluten-free stuff.
Yeah, we have
stuff.
What is that one we use? Almond flour or something?
Oh, it's
fine almond.
Blanched almond flour.
Yes.
Is
so,
my new favorite thing.
It's a little different than almond meal, which, you know, it's a little chunkier.
Coarser.
Yeah. So this one I know we used made a pizza crust last week, which was pretty good.
Pizza crust, made cookies. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
All right, so the last one we're going to get into is probably everyone, probably the biggest one. I mean, I can't say biggest one because they're all kind of
This is my pet peeve. This is my pain point one right here.
Yeah, organic, the organic label.
Freaking bastards.
I'm going to read what the USDA, what they call organic or what they classify as organic. Organic food labeling requirements. The amount of organic food in a product determines the label. Product labeled as 100% organic must contain only organic produced ingredients and processing aids. No non-organic ingredients or additives are added or permitted. Product labels with just the word organic must contain at least 95% organically produced ingredients. Food products with either of these organic claims must be grown, handled, and processed without the use of pesticides or other synthetic chemicals. Irradiation, fertilizer made with synthetic ingredients or bioengineering. Processed products that contain at least 70% organic ingredients can use the phrase made with organic ingredients and can list up to 3 of the organic ingredients or food groups on the principal display panel.
So we'll say this is a relatively newer program for the USDA. This is not something that's been in place for ages. So if you used to go to Whole Foods like 10 years ago and you used to see organic, this was not around. This program came out of constant and horrible abuse of the word organic on labels. And I feel like I was one of many kind of people 10 years ago where we started getting on that organic bandwagon, that trend, a little bit like earlier than just the general public. I happened to be like vegan at that point. So, I mean, there was a lot of reasons. But I had such a bitch of a time finding out what the hell it meant. That, like, this really is, like, one of the most annoying terms that I think finally there is some oversight. The National Organic Program, there are 3 labels. Now, you have to pay attention to those 3 labels, and we'll quickly kind of cover what they are again. 100% organic is what, if you're looking for something that's never touched, you know, non-organic materials, 100% organic. That's the golden standard, if you can imagine looking for that. If you just see the label organic, which really is what you see on most things, it's 95% organic. So there's still some room for non-organic, but it's mostly organic. Then you get into, I think, I'm really glad they added this one, but it's made with organic ingredients is the 3rd label, and that means that only 70% of the ingredients are made with organics. So the three are very close from just a quick glance sort of thing, but they are, like, if you carefully look for the labels, you now can find something that's relatively truthful.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there used to be private organizations that kind of led the charge and movement for organic, just like you're seeing with the non-GMO. The private labels still are very valid. They still have much stricter standards, I think, than even the USDA has.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nice to see that this is an official program and that they've gone through the classification to break it down into even like three labels.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how well they enforce it, which is what makes me nervous. But generally speaking, we've come a long way.
Right. Yeah, it's good. You can tell that people like yourself who kind of rose, you know,
were a little bit of a hippie.
But you were cause for concern. You were raising the you know, saying, hey, this is, you guys are misleading people. And it seems like some of the other previous terms that we were talking about, they've been yet to get that kind of push. And hopefully we're going the same way with those, with like gluten-free or non-GMO. It seems the GMO one's kind of the next one, it seems like to me. They're really kind of breaking down.
Yeah.
So we mentioned, this is healthylivingmadesimple.com. The article is actually written by Shea Raubach, who's a registered dietitian and nutritionist at the University of Miami. So she gave us a lot of good insight. I really appreciate it. Another topic that I think, or another term that really is, I mean,
it's everywhere.
It's in the news, and I mean, people really, and I mean, even me don't even have an understanding of what it means nowadays.
Yeah.
And that's the term grass fed.
Yeah, I heard them talking about this on NPR recently, and I didn't know at that time kind of the reason that it was a trending topic, but they sort of sparked my curiosity when they talked about sort of what it is, like what is grass-fed, and does it really have a definition that's consistent across all these various products? Because we look for it. We look for grass-fed on, yep, like our beef products,
mm-hmm,
and it's been sort of like a stamp of approval, and we've usually migrated to get grass-fed products. But now I feel like I've been taken for a bit of a ride.
Yeah, recently, actually beginning part of this year, the Agricultural Marketing Service, which is a part of the USDA, they kind of dropped the classification of grass-fed. They dropped their definition, as you know, they still give kind of certifications for grass-fed products, but now they don't even have a definition for it.
That's not encouraging.
Which is, yeah, like you said, is kind of disheartening for people who really, you know, are searching for grass-fed pasture raised, or I'm sorry, that's probably a different kind of you know, classification.
It's a different term.
But grass-fed products, because of what I've understand, what I've learned, or what I've read, is that grass-fed beef tends to have better kind of a fat profile. The omega-3s to omega-6 ratio is better than conventional raised. And then you look at it really based on the conditions the animals lived in, you know, animal welfare, from an animal welfare standpoint, you know, grass-fed is kind of, you know, they're eating grass, which is their preferred food source, or the food source they were meant to eat. And also, everybody knows of kind of the factory farming situation that exists in the United States, which in a lot of instances is very deplorable. I mean, I'm sure people have seen some of the videos of the conditions some of the cows live in.
Yeah, if anybody wants a, like, little bit lighter version of lighter meaning, don't go watch a video, whatever you do.
Watching Food Inc. is probably
you'll be scarred for life. But I read the book Skinny Bitch, which was like a big, like, kind of opened my eyes to a lot of things, but there was a lot of good research in there, and they had some stories. It was easier to read, I felt, but it still was so disturbing. I didn't know, like, you know, exactly the extent, and it just, you should know where your food comes from, even if you are always going to eat meat. But it's eye-opening, and I've since started, I actually work with a company that is specializes in pork and Angus beef. And I've learned a lot about responsible practices. So it's definitely something to look into. But yeah, don't watch a video or else you're not going to sleep for a week.
Another book that's good is Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan.
That's a great book.
It's interesting. There's a part he actually buys a steer. He buys it from essentially once it's born all the way raised to till it's
kind of
slaughtered.
I think people do that now.
Yeah, I mean, and he watches it, but he buys a conventional raised one.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets to watch it go through the factory and farming system, which is, it's, I mean, it's an older book too, so I'm sure there's been updates to it. But I think with the grass-fed, the issue is that it's now, even more so, is that it's more expensive product. It is harder to produce. I mean, feeding a cow on grass, mainly grass, opposed to corn, takes longer. So it takes more resources. I've heard conflicting statistics about if it takes more water per acre or more acreage or something like that. But, you know, understandably, you need more acres of grass to raise a grass-fed beef than when you're feeding corn. You know, so that's generally why the price tag is higher.
Yeah,
it's because it's harder to produce.
People think that the beef is gonna be healthier. It's gonna be more nutritious. It's gonna carry less harmful bacteria, which I think is kind of always been the issue with grain-fed beef.
Yep.
But yeah, you buy it because you're like, well, this is better beef.
Right, and there's a lot of scientific support for that, and there's some conflicting ones, but I've seen some conflicting ones where funded by beef industry, so obviously their interests.
Agenda.
So I'm a fan of grass-fed beef, but now, I mean, going to the grocery store and buying grass-fed, you see there, you don't know what percentage of their life they raised on a pasture eating grass. Now that the USDA has kind of dropped the definition, people can producers can kind of just try to apply for the label of grass fed without having really being providing an animal that was raised on grass.
Yeah,
so that's kind of scary. And I think this article we're looking at now, which is pretty good, it goes into a variety of topics, is from Tech Insider, which is interesting. It's under their science portion. It's from Julia Calderon. It's from March of this year. And the title is, You May Want to Think Twice Before Buying Expensive Grass-Fed Beef. We'll definitely put this link on the show notes on elementaltampa.com so you guys can read it. She goes through a variety of topics and really kind of looks at all the issues pertaining to grass-fed beef.
Yeah.
What I want to say is, I'm a big believer in like pasture-raised grass-fed beef.
Mm-hmm.
When we go to farmers markets around here, we try to talk to the farmers and we buy their products. We really try to do that. I know we've already mentioned that we have one of our neighbors is part of a CSA who, you know, she connects directly with farmers to provide, you know, organic and grass-fed beef to her customers. So, and not only grass-fed beef, but milk products, eggs, everything like that. So, and I think really that's kind of the way to go when you're looking into getting more food that's not only more nutritious, but also is, I think, in my opinion, it's better for the welfare of the environment.
Yeah.
Welfare of the animals and for the environment. Because when you look at, on a small scale, small farms, it really is kind of what the nation is going away from. You know, that's what we were built on, small farms. And then all of a sudden the agricultural, you know, the industrialization of agriculture, which is kind of almost like an oxymoron, but it's kind of happened now with the factory farms and wide-scale agriculture and the production of huge monocultures like corn, grain, and soybean. Mm-hmm. So I think kind of connecting with the small farms and spending a little extra money on their products to help them kind of stay relevant, stay in business, that's kind of you're helping not only the animals, not only the environment, but you're helping other individuals kind of help you be healthier. And I think honestly, it's kind of large scale, but I think it's making a better kind of environment, you know,
yeah,
locally too.
Well, and there's a term that I recently saw was slapped on one of my clients' campaigns, shop local. That is actually a term. It's not a nutrition term, mm-hmm. but it is a marketing slogan that is more of a call to action that actually does mean something good. And I think that at the root, it really does, especially when you're talking about food items, getting food items from locally produced. Now, not just like a local store that's carrying food, but like locally produced items is going to serve not only you, but your community and on a larger scale, the economy much better, the environment too.
Yeah.
So it's worth taking a look at where these things, I know we've always kind of gone back to the same idea, know where your food comes from.
Right.
But when it comes to labels, you do have to be a responsible consumer. There's a lot of terms out there, you know, you've got grass-fed, free-range, I think is another one.
Pasture-raised,
yeah. Natural,
yeah.
All these different terms. It is tough to know which is which.
Right.
So as a consumer, you kind of have to do your due diligence. You have to make sure you understand the terms, know which ones kind of align with what fits your lifestyle, and think about trying to shrink that circle of places that you're actually getting food from.
Mm-hmm.
Because the shorter the distance from you that your food is made, the better overall, basically all parties are.
Right. Yeah, that's good. There's, like you said, less resources are used to either get the food to you and so on and so forth. So
yep.
That's a good way to kind of end this episode. Like you say, it's tough buying all those products. I mean, we know money. I mean, we don't even always buy all organic or grass-fed. We can't.
They say in this article that grass-fed usually on average costs about $2.50 to $3 more per pound.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if you're buying multiple pounds of grass-fed meat? Holy moly, that alone is going to eat up your pocketbook.
Yeah. It's tough. So we understand that not everybody can afford to, and sometimes even we can't afford to.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think connecting with, like you said, local shopping or local sources is probably the best way to go. All right, so I think we dealt out enough information on this episode. I'm happy to announce that I did the interview this week with Nicole Racine, which we talked about last week. It was an awesome interview. I was extremely thankful for her taking the time out of her busy schedule to join me for a podcast. And you guys will hear that next week. That interview will be featured next week. So she talks about a lot of interesting topics, specifically focused on nutrition and how we can kind of maybe reverse the obesity and type 2 diabetes trend we're seeing in the United States. So
I'm excited to hear it.
Yes, that's going to be a great episode, guys. So please make sure you tune in next week. And as always, please rate, review, and share the podcast. We love giving you guys information each week, and we love hearing back from you guys. Feel free to leave comments or any type of feedback is greatly appreciated. All right, you got anything else for him this week?
I don't.
All right. This has been another Addicted to Fitness podcast, and we'll check you next time.
Bye.
If you want to learn more about Elemental Training Tampa, check us out on Facebook or go to our website, elementaltampa.com. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter under the handle ETTampa. Please rate and review the podcast. Your feedback will help us get better. Thanks.
That's right.
Him and his wife were inspecting.
They were inspecting a baby.
Wow.